Tapes from the Dark Side contains descriptions of violence and sexuality. Listener discretion is advised.
I think everyone has a bit of a fascination with the dark side. I myself have always loved the dark side as well. I think it's something that everyone secretly longs for and wants.
We got all the kids are dead in the house.
Okay, how many people?
Six kids, one adult.
Six kids and one adult?
Yeah, one of them is a baby.
In the last episode, we took a detour from our main narrative to explore the broken DCF system in Florida, a critical part of our story because it helps explain the causes and conditions that make an event like the Spirit Family Massacre possible. I believe that degenerative acts like this one are only as sick as the societies in which they occur. This event shows us firsthand what happens when mental illness, drug abuse, in a broken political system collide to create the perfect storm. In this episode, we will return to our main narrative in the subject of Season 3, The Spirit Family, to finish the telling of this tragic tale, and to see if we might be able to glean something from the physical, emotional, and spiritual wreckage that was caused on that fateful day in 2014. The antagonist of our story, Don Spirit, carried with himself a lengthy criminal history spanning nearly three decades. Let's do a quick review of the crimes we know about. The New Jersey mystery, when Don Spirit was extradited from Florida back to the Garden State on a felony warrant in 1990, of which the details are still unknown. Battery in 1992, driving without a license and accident involving death in 94. Depriving a child of food and shelter in 95, felony possession of marijuana in 1998, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon accident resulting in death in 2001, which makes six major violent crimes in just over a decade, and we have yet to examine what could be, besides for the massacre, considered the most egregious offense in all of Don Spirit's criminal history. 2001 was the year Don Spirit accidentally killed his son in a tragic hunting accident. If you'll recall, he was arrested and charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and was awaiting trial, which would eventually occur nearly 2 years later, in 2003. And thusly, Don was given a kind of unofficial and unstated test. Could he be on his best behavior for these 2 years before the trial occurred? Could he perhaps show the judge and the court that despite his violent past, he could be a respectable and useful member of society? Yet, if this was a test, Don failed it miserably. In September of 2002, less than 1 year after the hunting accident, while Don was awaiting trial, violence again erupted at the Spirit household. Police were called on a report of domestic abuse. Deputies arrived on scene to discover Christine Spirit's year 2000 Chevy Trailblazer, only 2 years old at this point, with its windows completely smashed out. Upon investigation, they learned Don had taken a sledgehammer to the car after an argument with his wife. Christine showed no signs of having been physically abused, but she told officers that she feared for her life and that Don had verbally threatened to kill her. Don and Christine's son Josh, who was 12 at the time, said he witnessed his father smash in the windows of the Trailblazer. And what is perhaps the most disturbing part of this entire report, Josh said he was present when his father threatened in cold blood to kill his mother. Christine chose not to press charges, and she made no formal statement regarding the violent threats made against her by her husband. This might be baffling to some, but looking back in retrospect, it appears that Christine was caught in the maladaptive and dysfunctional cycle of spousal abuse. Intimate partner violence affects more than 12 million people each year in the USA. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men will be the victim of severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. There are a number of reasons why victims of domestic violence will often stay with their partners far longer than anyone from the outside looking in would judge reasonable. All of the individual factors that go into making the decision to stay with an abusive partner appear to be rooted in warped and distorted thought patterns. I would argue that distorted thinking is actually the brain's natural response to abuse. The human mind is an incredibly powerful thing, and it can warp our perception of reality in such a way that we're able to withstand incredible emotional and physical abuse. Situations that might have initially felt unacceptable or even unlivable after time start to appear normal. Abusive men and women tend to select partners who exhibit signs of low self-esteem. This is so they can exert maximum control. All abusers are ultimately obsessed with control. They will exploit their partner's low self-esteem to isolate them from their friends, family, and colleagues. This creates a dysfunctional, dependent relationship where the person being abused has no way to compare their version of reality to the outside world. The word gaslight is overused these days, but a true abuser will gaslight their victim to make them feel as if they're deserving of this mental and physical abuse. And tragically, once the person who's being abused begins to entertain the idea that they deserve this abuse, it can become an ingrained part of their subconscious, so much so that it can take years, and in some cases, an entire lifetime of reconditioning and therapeutic work to reverse these dysfunctional thought patterns. I don't mean to harp on this subject, but the resulting paradox of an abusive situation is something I find fascinating. And the paradox is this. For the one being abused, the thought that they deserve this abuse is ironically comforting, carries with it a sense of hope, which is ultimately a false hope. But in the moment, this delusion can be seductive. Because if we are to blame for the abuse we receive, then it appears to us that control is in our hands. The delusion that some kind of misbehavior causes the abuse means that if we choose to behave, we could avoid the abuse. This will prove to be tragically incoherent. There is nothing a person could do to warrant being abused, and so there is nothing a person could change to warrant not being abused. To demonstrate how intense domestic abuse can distort the thinking mind, we have to look no further than Christine Spirit's letter she wrote to the judge in the felony case against her husband back in 2003, the one in which she begged the judge not to lock up Don Spirit, her husband. Keep in mind that she wrote this letter, the one we reviewed in episode 3, 1 year after the incident in which Don Spirit smashed out every window in her car and threatened to end her life in front of her own child. We're not going to reread the entire letter. It's there in episode 3 if you want to review it. But I do want to bring up one line again, in which Christine, addressing the judge, writes, "The children and I have been his life support, and by taking him away from us, you could kill him." Notice how Don Spirit is the innocent martyr. There is no responsibility assigned to him. There is no acknowledgement that he broke the law. It's true that if Don had simply petitioned the court before 2001, he likely would have had his firearm rights legally restored, but that is something he did not do. In retrospect, we know the tragic truth of the matter is the direct opposite of what Christine wrote, that by not removing Don from his children and his grandchildren, this led not only to Don Spirit's eventual death, but also to his daughter's death and his grandchildren's deaths as well. Don was ultimately able to evade jail time for the abuse of his wife, Christine. but was not able to do the same for the felony firearm possession charge. And in 2003, Don Spirit was sentenced to 3 years in state prison, where he would remain until 2006. One rare bright spot in the story is that in nearly the middle of his sentence, for reasons that are obscure to the outside world, Christine had a change of heart that would lead her to making perhaps the best legal and personal decision of her life. It also ended up being a decision that was potentially life-saving. Christine filed for divorce from Don Spirit in 2005. In this petition, she claimed Don had assaulted her several times since they were wed in December of 1989. The judge granted the divorce without delay, and just like that, 15 years of marriage had officially come to its end. Although it's true we can acknowledge that on this day, Christine gained her freedom, and we can say that this probably saved her life, it's not exactly something we can celebrate. Christine is perhaps the one in this entire story with whom my greatest sympathies lie. On September 18th, 2014, Christine not only lost her ex-husband, but she also lost her daughter and all six of her grandchildren. Not to mention that 13 years prior, she suffered the loss of her son. That seems to me like more grief than one person should ever be made to bear. I've heard it said that losing a child is like seeing the pages of a book from your life ripped out and shredded before your eyes. Not only does Christine have to manage the unimaginable pain of losing multiple children and grandchildren, but we can probably assume that she struggles with survivor's guilt. A quote I came across recently from a man named Jonathan Harnish, an author, is, "The most painful goodbyes are the ones that are left unsaid and never explained." We can analyze and discuss DCF and their failings. We can examine Don Spirit's criminal past and what was missed by DCF investigators. We can talk about Don Spirit's drug abuse as mental illness. Yet, I'm convinced that you can never provide a comprehensive and satisfactory explanation for the tragedy that occurred on that day. To murder your entire family, it violates nearly every natural law and human evolutionary impulse. I know that we spent the majority of the last episode ripping into the Florida DCF, and I do stand by those criticisms. I think there were enough reasons for the department at a bare minimum to create a defined safety plan that removed the grandchildren from Don Spirit's care or even presence. That being said, I don't think anyone could expect the kind of incomprehensible act from Don Spirit or from any human being. While responsibility lies with DCF for their failings, and to a certain extent with Sarah Spirit and her failings as a mother, I think we need to make one thing clear. The ultimate responsibility for what occurred on that date in 2014 lies with one man, Don Spirit. We cannot allow him in death to do what he did in life over and over and over again, which is escape the responsibility of his actions. Don could not make it one full year before getting in legal trouble again. In less than 10 months after his release, the cops were called during an incident in which he assaulted his then 18-year-old son, Josh. On December 18th of 2006, police were called to the Spirit residence. Don had allegedly punched his son Josh because he was upset that his son had committed the ultimate betrayal. Josh had allegedly let one of his friends wear one of Don's jackets. There's no explanation in the report of why this angered Don so much. Josh ultimately decided not to press charges. Sarah was also present at the time, and when questioned by police, she declined to make a statement. There's no record of this incident in DCF's notes. 5 months after this alleged assault, in May of 2007, Don was charged for driving while intoxicated when he wrecked his car into a tree, not before taking down one of his neighbor's mailboxes. Don was intoxicated, going 60 miles per hour in a 55, heading northbound on County Road 341 in Trenton, Florida, when he veered right off the single-lane road onto the curb where he destroyed a mailbox. Hitting the brakes, Don abruptly swerved left back onto the roadway, where he overcorrected, drifting into the oncoming lane of traffic, thankfully missing any vehicles, and then losing complete control, he went over the left bank and pinballed his car between two trees. Police arrived and Don Spirit refused a drug test, but reportedly smelled of alcohol and appeared drunk. He did $7,000 of damage to his 1999 Isuzu and $100 of damage to the mailbox. He pled no contest to a reduced charge of reckless driving, was ordered to community service, and fined $657. If you're thinking that this debacle with drunk driving might lead to a change of heart for Don Spirit, perhaps a new law-abiding attitude, well, you would be sorely mistaken. Coming up after the break, we will examine what is, in my opinion, the most disturbing event in Don Spirit's past. Stay with us. My name is TZ, and I'm the host and creator of Tapes from the Dark Side, and I'm going to keep this short. Our show is able to exist because of listeners just like yourself who have become patrons. We don't run any ads, so you are our number one and only source of funding. If you enjoy the show and you want to hear more quality content and also get access to bonus content and other rewards, go and check out our Patreon. It takes less than 1 minute to sign up and starts at only $1 a month. Patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. Once again, that's patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. That's it. Let's get back to the show. In the year 2008, Florida Gilchrist County Police were called to Don Spirit's trailer home on a Wednesday night, August 27th. A verbal exchange between Sarah Spirit and her father turned violent. They were having a heated discussion about money that Sarah allegedly promised to pay her father. This money was supposed to be used for property taxes on the trailer, and Don was understandably upset that his daughter was not contributing financially to the household. Though with three mouths to feed, Sarah often found herself with no money left over. During the discussion, Don's temper broke, and he pushed his daughter up against the refrigerator and physically assaulted her. The police report reads, Don grabbed her by the arms, shoved her up against the fridge, and then took both his hands, placed them close to the sides of her face, and boxed her cheeks very hard, leaving red marks on them just below the eyes. That in and of itself would be disturbing enough, but the real horror lies in the fact that Sarah was at the time 36 weeks pregnant and due to give birth to who would be Destiny Stewart in exactly 1 month. To add insult to injury, Sarah's three-year-old daughter Kylie witnessed the attack. Sarah fled the house with Kylie as Don screamed after her, warning that she dare not call the police on him, which is exactly what she did. As soon as she was a safe distance from the trailer home, Sarah dialed 911 on her cell phone and reported the assault. When cops arrived at the mobile home, they saw that Don had barricaded himself inside the house, locking all the doors and windows. He told the police he was, quote, going to take himself out. And when they were unable to gain entry into the residence by way of negotiation, they suited up in tactical gear armed with rifles and prepared to take the house by force. In the police report, there is this quote, "The only way we were going to get him to come out is to break down the front door and throw in tear gas." Except before any such attempt could be made, to everyone's surprise, Don, unarmed and not posing a threat, exited the trailer and promptly surrendered. He was taken into custody and held at the county jail. Sarah filed for an order of protection, and initially things looked promising for her. This horrific situation might be worth the pain if it could kickstart her on a path of physical and emotional independence from her abusive father. Yet, tragically, Sarah had a change of heart. A court document shows that she failed to appear to confirm the domestic order in October, and so it was summarily dismissed. But going much further than that, Sarah would petition the court in a letter that carried a near identical tone to her mother's letter during the 2003 trial from 5 years earlier. In stark contrast to her mother's typed letter with a stamped header, Sarah's letter is handwritten on a page of three-hole punch loose-leaf paper. I'd like to read that letter for you now to show you just how twisted Sarah's thinking had become, likely a direct result of the abuse she suffered at the hands of her father. Notice how many times Sarah takes responsibility for Don's actions or makes excuses for his behavior. Attention, for the judge that has Don Spirit's case. To who this may concern, my name is Sarah Spirit. I am the daughter of Don Spirit. My father is in jail, and I am the cause of that. Me and my father fight all the time, like a normal family does. I've been very stressed out lately, and so has my father, and things got out of hand. I love my father. He is the only family I have, and he is a big part of mine and my children's life. My father is a good person. He just has a lot of emotional problems. My baby brother died about 5 years ago while in my dad's custody, and that is something he's had to deal with for the rest of his life. Ever since my brother died, my dad hasn't been emotionally or mentally stable. He has a lot of problems, but he would never hurt someone intentionally. Everyone has problems, and sometimes people need some help and guidance. Please have mercy on my father and don't take him away from his only reason to live. I forgive him for what he did, and I am willing to stand by his side and help him through his problems. He will die if he goes to prison, and it would kill me inside to know I put him there. I know I shouldn't have took it as far as I did by calling the cops, but I have been really stressed out, and it was a bad day for me, and I regret it. If this letter doesn't convince you that Sarah was suffering from not only physical abuse, but also emotional and psychological abuse from her father, then there truly is nothing that would. The entire letter reflects a warped view of reality, but one line in particular sticks out for me. Quote, "My father's in jail, and I am the cause of that. He will die if he goes to prison, and it would kill me inside to know I put him there." This is such a grossly inaccurate interpretation of reality that it surpasses ordinary misunderstanding and clearly enters the territory of delusion. I'm going to state the obvious, so bear with me. Sarah Spirit did not cause her father to physically assault her. Sarah did not and never had the power to put her father in prison. Don Spirit is the one who assaulted his daughter. Don Spirit is the one and only person responsible for his actions. And if that action resulted in a prison sentence, then so be it. The letter is so outrageous that it reads like it could have been written by Don Spirit himself, though this is likely not the case, as Don was behind bars at the time, and the cursive writing on the surface appears to indicate a feminine touch. But we also don't know if Sarah could have called Don while he was in jail and perhaps got some kind of coaching on how to word the letter. In what was purely a stroke of luck, in my research, I stumbled across Don Spirit's own letter to the judge in this case, which I didn't even know existed. I'm also going to read this to you, as it grants us a rare look inside the mind of a killer. Don writes, "To your honorable Judge Lott, my name is Don Spirit. My daughter has written me a letter stating she does not want to testify against me. I know you also have received a letter from her. I've written a letter to my attorney to file a motion for dismissal because of this letter. Based on 2004 14-B FLA 2D Criminal Law 1650, I would have the right to face my accuser. I've asked to have set for speedy trial,
I was told by my attorney that would be accomplished within 175 days. My daughter and I would like to bring this to an end. Thank you for your time and consideration. Sincerely, Dawn Spirit.
Setting aside the legal reference, let's focus on what is not in Dawn Spirit's letter. Acceptance of responsibility, sense of remorse, a desire to take accountability, or even a simple apology, all of which are clearly present in Sarah's letter. If you didn't know the facts of the case, you would likely incorrectly assume that Sarah was the aggressor against her father, though we should say that Dawn's letter is addressed to the court, and as such, we should recognize that anytime the legal system is involved, there is often a lack of candidness, which can be a part of a broader legal strategy. I looked up Dawn Spirit's legal reference to the 14-B FLA 2D Criminal Law 1650, but could find nothing from a Google search or any further research. It could be part of an outdated law or something that is more obscure. I'm not sure. Though I will say this part of the letter reads to me as a veiled threat. Quote, I would have a right to face my accuser, almost as if daring the court to bring the case to trial. And it's no mystery why Don was eager to have this case thrown out. A dismissal would mean he would once again avoid the legal consequences of his actions, which in this case was a most serious charge, physical abuse of a pregnant woman, and not just pregnant, but 9 months pregnant, merely weeks away from giving birth. Don would accept the state's offer of a lesser charge of misdemeanor battery, and he pled no contest. He was forced to pay fines and court costs totaling $498, and he was sentenced to county jail. Credited with the nearly 4 months he had already served, he only had to stay behind bars another 67 days. He would be out of jail by February 23rd of 2009. And we know how the rest of the story goes. From February 2006 to the date of the tragedy, roughly 8 years later, the Spirit family was involved in 18 child protective investigations that ranged from allegations of abandonment to abuse and neglect. Over these years, DCF found the 6 Spirit children suffering from inadequate food, inadequate clothing, abandonment, failure to thrive, violence, threats of violence, burns, inadequate supervision, medical neglect, bone fractures, substance misuse, environmental hazards, and physical injury. The alleged perpetrators named throughout these investigations were Edward Coleman, James Stewart, Sarah Spirit, and Dawn Spirit, the first two being the children's fathers. Sarah was not a completely innocent actor in this situation. In fact, she was the alleged perpetrator in 12 of the 18 cases, only 2 of which were confirmed by DCF. She surely was not in the running for any Mother of the Year awards, though she also seemed to have made a sincere effort to provide for her children, perhaps the best way she knew how. Remember that Sarah was only 17 years old, merely a child herself, when she gave birth to Caleb. She never completed high school, worked briefly as a grocery store and fast food attendant, and her health was an ongoing battle. Sarah was born with only 1 kidney and had a long history of complications that resulted in sickness and hospitalizations throughout her life. She had a history of seizures, anxiety disorder, and also pelvic inflammatory disease. It is likely that Sarah sought escape from her mental and physical ailments through addictive substances, leading her to the documented abuse of the drug called Spice. Not that it's a valid excuse, but it's worth noting that Sarah's abuse of her children was passive in nature. She would disappear from the home for days and even weeks at a time, during which the children would be left to be cared for by relatives or friends. In 2012, DCF was called on reports of neglect and found her children suffering from chronic and untreated head lice. They also found, quote, a lack of follow-through on cleaning and caring for a cut on Caleb's foot. The details of this incident are much more gruesome than the report might initially suggest. After Caleb had cut his foot on a piece of glass, Sarah tried to treat the wound by soaking it in bleach and then wrapping it in tissues and duct tape. The 9-year-old Caleb finally received proper medical care a full 12 days later when a school nurse discovered the infected foot and demanded the boy be immediately taken to a proper doctor's office for treatment. The DCF report on the incident concluded that the child's needs were being seen to with the help of others. Don Spirit was involved in 6 of the 18 CPI incidents and was the alleged perpetrator in 3. Although not named a perp in the other investigations, we should remember that the family was either residing with Don Spirit, or at the very least, he was visiting their home when all 18 of the critical incidents occurred. He was supervising when a child was burned by a space heater. He was outside with Brandon when the child fractured his arm in 2013, both of which appear to be nothing more than normal childhood accidents. Yet, in a Child Protective Team forensic interview in May 2013, barely 1 year before the massacre, several of the children expressed fear of their grandfather. In their final report, the Child Protective Team stated that Don Spirit should, quote, have no unsupervised contact with his grandchildren, a recommendation that was never incorporated into a formal safety plan. Shortly before the massacre, in the summer of 2014, Sarah Spirit failed a drug test that was administered by her probation officer, and she was subsequently taken to jail. Upon her release, she and her 6 children were kicked out of the Bell home where they lived, and that is when she made the decision that would result in disaster, to move back in with her abusive father, Don Spirit. We don't know for sure, but it's possible that this was Sarah's last lifeline, aside from maybe a woman's shelter or homelessness. It's not clear if Sarah's mom, Christine, could have potentially allowed them to stay with her, or if maybe a friend, perhaps the children's aunt, Colleen, might have been able to help with housing. What we do know is that DCF was nowhere to be found when it came to assisting with this most important decision. And, like we said before, no formal safety plan forbids Sarah from cohabitating with her known abuser and father. Filicide is one of the most egregious crimes in our society, perhaps the most. The deliberate act of a parent killing their own child. In the case of the Spirit family, a more accurate term might be familicide, or what we have already learned is also known as family annihilation. It's defined as when a family member, usually a parent, kills their entire family and then usually commits suicide. And while Don Spirit was a parent, he was also a grandparent. Little to no research has been done on these most unique of all family annihilators. Filicide, while being both shocking and highly unusual in itself, is exceedingly more common than death by grandparent. While almost no research has been done on the latter, the research that has been done on filicide can help us make some inferences about this other, more rare type of killer. FBI research shows that around 450 children each year are murdered by their parents in the United States. A man named Dr. Philip Resnick is one of the leading experts on the subject. Resnick authored a landmark 1969 study that found that among parents who kill their children, mothers and fathers usually commit this unspeakable act for distinctly disparate reasons. Mothers are most likely to kill newborns because of mental illness, such as postpartum depression or a stress disorder, while fathers typically kill for more practical or malicious reasons. Resnick's research has helped shape this field of study and sets a foundation that recognizes 5 specific potential motivations for a filicidal act. These are as follows: 1, altruistic; 2, acutely psychotic; 3, unwanted child; 4, accidental; and lastly, the most insidious of the 5, spousal revenge. The last of these, and the most rare, spousal revenge, is usually reserved for male offenders. A perpetrator who commits filicide with a vengeful motive sees his children as merely objects. The negation of their humanity is essential to being able to use them as pawns in their scheme to commit what is perhaps the most cruel and heinous act of revenge. In the Dawn Spirit case, I see minimal evidence to suggest that the massacre was motivated by revenge. Though Dawn Spirit's past aggression towards Sarah and statements about the children, such as, "I don't love them, I hate them," shows it could have played a secondary role. Even less relevant is accidental death. In this case, it's non-applicable, as it's reserved for cases in which a parent, for lack of a better term, abuses their child to death, meaning they purposefully inflict pain or punishment of some kind, but the abuse goes too far and they end up unintentionally killing the child. And then we have what are, in my non-professional opinion, and I do emphasize non-professional, three of Resnick's classifications that I believe played the primary motivation: acute psychopathy, unwanted children, and lastly, altruistic filicide. In 2009, Dawn Spirit was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. It's unclear whether he underwent professional treatment or if he was even prescribed medication. We do know that Dawn was a habitual user and likely addict of the psychotropic drug known as Spice. We could make an educated guess that Dawn's mental illness was intensified manyfold by his use of this drug. The unwanted children category is self-explanatory, and in Don's case, it's clear he was an unwilling participant in the raising of his daughter's children. He harbored explicit resentment around his de facto adoption of this role. As mentioned before, he allegedly told Sarah, "I don't love them, I hate them." Lastly, we have the most complicated, and in my opinion, the most fascinating category, those so-called altruistic murders. Altruism is characterized by a selfless concern for the well-being of others, which immediately presents us with a glaring contradiction. You would obviously never hurt someone you selflessly love, much less kill them. Yet, if we take the time to examine this seeming inconsistency, we might reach a different conclusion. The practical reality of our world is that medical decisions are made every day by the families of loved ones to end that person's life. These decisions are complicated and the motivating factors vary on a case-by-case basis. They almost always involve grave medical conditions where the estimated future quality of life is bleak. With this, they share a common link with the motivation behind altruistic filicide, and they also share something much less obvious: the selfless concern for someone you love. Resnick points to perceived gender roles as either a mother or a father as potentially complicating a person's ability to reason through these situations logically. The responsibility a parent feels towards their child is molded by society, and when those roles are not fulfilled, a parent can experience intense guilt and shame. Resnick writes, "A man sees himself as the main support of a family. He may feel like it's his responsibility to not let his family suffer. In the case of Dawn Spirit, he could barely afford to pay his own property taxes and stay out of jail himself. Not to mention, he was witnessing his own daughter actively descend into the same spiral of destitution of which he himself was all too familiar. In and out of jail, abusing drugs, in a much more recent development of prostitution." Sarah was 28 years old, with 6 children by 2 fathers, one who was mostly absent from the picture due to incarceration. And so, my question is this. Dawn Spirit had resigned himself to a life of poverty, deprivation, and hardship. Then, in recent years, he did the same for his daughter. Did he begin to see the same fate as the inevitable conclusion for his grandchildren? And perhaps the real question is, how could he not at least entertain the idea? I'd like to end this season by discussing one of the most famous, or rather infamous, cases of filicide, relevant not only because it features a so-called altruistic filicide, but also because Dr. Philip Resnick himself testified as the forensic psychiatrist for the defense. Andrea Yates was the mother of 5 children, who she one by one drowned in the bathroom of their Texas home back in 2001. coincidentally the same year as Don's fatal hunting accident.
Now, at the time of the homicides, Mrs. Yates had the five children, aged 6 months to 7 years, and I asked her how she decided which order she was going to drown her children, and she said there was no particular order, it was just whichever child was around, and each one she held face down in the bathtub. It turns out that John had been a very good big brother to Mary. So after drowning Mary, she took Mary out of the bathtub, and this is a picture of John and Mary taken not on the day of their death. But she then placed Mary, dead Mary, in the crook of dead John's arm so he would look after her in the afterlife. Now, when she was drowning Noah was 7, 50 pounds, pretty big, strong kid. And when she drowned Noah, he resisted some, and he got his head above water, and he said, "Mommy, I'm sorry." I mentioned that to you because one of the tasks of the prosecutor in a case like this is to make the crime unforgivable.
Similar to Don's spirit, Andrea was suffering from acute mental illness, but in her case it was of a different variety, postpartum depression and schizophrenia. She was ultimately found not guilty by reason of insanity, and as of 2021 remains in Kerrville State Hospital.
She was considered one of the most reprehensible women in the United States, and 63% of the American public wanted to see her be executed. Let me just comment a little more broadly about societal attitudes toward the insanity defense. A myth is something that never was true but always will be, and there are several in the area of insanity. The first is how often it is raised. The public believes it is raised 40 times more often than it is. It's actually raised in 0.9, less than 1% of felonies, and the jury perceived it, the public perceived it as being raised in 37% of felony trials. Only 1/3 believe it is wrong to punish the insane. Now think about that, it is shocking. It's inconsistent. If someone's insane, they're categorically not responsible. But the public, only 1/3, believes that it's wrong to punish the insane. If a schizophrenic patient went off their antipsychotics, that is very important to jurors. They brought it on themselves. Or if they were using street drugs at the time, even though the actual illness that was schizophrenia, which caused the killing, they tend to be unforgiving. Another myth is that if people succeed with insanity, they beat the rap. In reality, there are a couple of studies showing that persons found not guilty by reason of insanity spend longer in a hospital than they would have spent in prison if they'd been convicted. In California, one study shows it's twice as long. For a misdemeanor, it's 9 times as long. So it's only a stupid attorney who raises an insanity defense in a misdemeanor case in terms of protecting the freedom of their client.
When Andrea was interviewed by police, she said, quote,
"I had made up my mind that I would do it. I just thought it had to be done, because just the prospect of them growing up to be unrighteous."
Andrea suffered from vivid paranoid delusions of who her children would become once they reached adulthood. She was convinced that her son John was destined to become a serial killer, and that another one of her sons, Paul, would become a deaf and mute homosexual prostitute.
She said that her children were not righteous. They were doomed to perish in the fires of hell. And she, as a deeply religious woman, meant this in a very literal way. She believed that she had ruined her children by her defective mothering. She believed that killing them was a sin. That's true. She did it because she believed it was a lesser sin. The idea that society would think it was bad, Mrs. Yates did say that to Dr. Dietz, but society did not know what fate her children would have the way Mrs. Yates did in her psychotic mind. Religion was like a trellis along which the delusions grew. So if you have someone who's deeply religious, it's not surprising that their delusions would hinge around religious themes. And then once you get into religious themes, and there's good and evil and the devil and God and heaven and hell, it may sound, you know, megalomaniacal to you, but religion has these concepts. And once you become psychotic and start dealing with these concepts, so I don't think it would take a narcissistic person to have such delusional ideas once she goes over that line into psychosis with her religious background.
While Don Spirit's life ended on that day, September of 2014, he might have been granted the better fate of the two. Here is an excerpt from the lecture of Dr. Resnick's discussing the trauma Andrea suffered when she emerged from her psychotic state.
Mrs. Yates' perception now of what she did, as a mother, I wonder how she lives with what she's done.
Yes, as a mother, the worst thing in life to happen to someone is to have your children predecease you. And in general, even to die in an accident. Then if they commit suicide, that's worse, because you're always second guessing, what did you do, what did you not see? And worse than suicide is having killed your children. So not only does she have to deal with like every birthday, every holiday, not having her children there, thinking how old they would be. So there's a great sadness, and actually there's extremely little recidivism among mothers who kill their children, but there is a significant rate of suicide of coping with what they have done. But she now recognizes she was psychotic and realizes that she needlessly killed her children. She has gone through agonizing, crying all night as she came to realize it while still in jail. Mrs. Yates was initially found incompetent to stand trial, which delayed her trial by several months. She was medicated. There's a concept called synthetic sanity where the courts have generally ruled that it's okay to medicate someone even against their will to establish sanity. But the second trial, she remained medicated, and she remains today on both an antipsychotic and antidepressant. And she had a couple of relapses in the several years since, so that she needs to be on significant doses of medication to stay non-psychotic. In other words, they haven't tried to lower her level. I personally diagnosed her with a condition called schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of schizophrenia and mood disturbance. And it is true that the incidence of postpartum psychosis is less than 1 in 1,000 of all women who have a baby. But in women with bipolar disorder, the incidence is 244 out of 1,000. So if someone has bipolar disorder, they're much, much more prone to have a mood disturbance at the time. When you have a baby, you not only have an alteration of hormones, but you're sleep deprived. And if you've got a vulnerability, it definitely can be brought out at that time.
We end the season with an anecdote from Dr. Resnick.
Well, let me conclude. This is Medea. You may know that there's a myth of Medea when rejected by Jason. She kills his two children. And what she says there when she's killing the two children is, to die by other hands more merciless than mine, no. I who gave them life will give them death. Oh, now, no cowardice, no thought how young they are, how dear they are, how when they first were born. One moment, one short moment, then forever sorrow. Whether women end up in prison or a psychiatric hospital, they indeed have forever sorrow. Thank you very much.
The physical pain that Don Spirit inflicted on those in his life came abruptly to an end on the day that he massacred his family and took his own life. But the sorrow that he sowed here on earth will echo through the memories of those he left behind. Rest in peace, Alana Stewart, Brandon Stewart, Destiny Stewart, Jonathan Coleman, Kylie Coleman, Caleb Coleman, Sarah Spirit, and Kyle Spirit. Thank you for listening to Season 3 of Tapes from the Dark Side. I appreciate you going on this journey with me, and I can't wait to bring you guys Season 4. It's already in the works. If you want to support the show, you can join our Patreon. It's a way to support the content you like and also get rewarded in the process. It takes less than a minute to sign up, and you can join for as low as $1 per month. 50% of all the funds raised on Patreon for the month of September will go to Child Help, which is the largest nonprofit organization in the U.S. dedicated to the prevention and treatment of child abuse. I'll post proof of that donation on October 1st on all of our social websites. Support a good cause and support the content that you enjoy. Become a patron today. Patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. Thank you to our newest Dark Stars, Maddie Lynch and Gregory Andres, and to our new $5 Darksiders, Michelle Pierce, Heather Roberts, and Nikki Rowland. A big, big thank you to all of our Dark Stars who put the team on their backs each month. Brooke Shell is our top supporter at $16.66 per month, Florida Gallagher at $11 a month, and at $10 a month, Emily Warner, Tara Rose, and Greg B. You guys are freaking legends. And we also have our $9 supporters, Alice Sontimer, Fran, Caitlin Bridges, Anthony Morlacci, Jamie Taylor, Jalen Ulbrich, JC LeVay, James Harrington, Laura Huggins, Christy Ramshire, Chelsea Perry, Hannah Jasinski, Candace Smith, Melanie Ochoa, Catherine Case, Bryson Bercy, Iza Loya, Heather Guada, Key Sardi, Kim Messer, and Erica Walters. Huge thank you to 2600, who allows us to use his music in our show and for our main theme. Thank you to Augusta Trevororum, who created exclusive tracks for this season. Both of those are linked in the full show notes on our Patreon episode page. Stay tuned till after the credits for a promo from a podcast called The Path Went Chilly. We'll see you guys next time.
Hi, I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold. If you are unfamiliar with my other podcast, I often cover stories from the television show Unsolved Mysteries. For the past 5 years, you've heard me talk about these cases on my own, but now's your chance to hear me have in-depth discussions about them with other people. I want to welcome you to my new project, The Path Went Chilly, where I will be discussing in-depth with my two good friends and co-hosts cases that I've covered on The Trail Went Cold. Meet my co-hosts. First one up is Jules.
Hi, I'm Jules from the podcast Riddle Me That True Crime, and I have a PhD in transpersonal counseling. I'm not a psychologist or a diagnostician, so don't get too excited. But I can't wait to analyze these cases with these two amazing humans. You've already met Robin, now meet Dr. Ashley Wellman.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I have a PhD in criminology, law, and society, and I specialize in trauma victims and survivors. I've spent a great deal of time working with families left behind after homicides with a cold case unit based out of Florida, and I'm also a professor of criminology. I'm so excited to be chatting with two of my best friends about the cases that everyone can't seem to get enough of.
We hope in doing so that we will have a clearer perspective of what may have transpired. Oftentimes, Ashley will be totally in the dark.
Jules and I will be telling Ashley a story she may not know much about, so all of her reactions are genuine.
We will be releasing on all major platforms April 8th.
We hope you will join us as we attempt to heat up some ice-cold cases.
The Path Went Chilly will be available every Thursday on all major podcast platforms.
Ooh, it tasted weird.
Yeah.
Right? Is it just...
a bit.
Ooh, maybe it's the tape. I didn't realize we dipped the fucking tape in it.
A dark side. Yes, God.